Hello and welcome to an extremely exciting edition of the Vacation Bible School podcast. We have reached the book of Leviticus.
We're out of Exodus.
We're out of Exodus. We have completed two books, and here we are 1 year after our first episode, completing our third book. We are on pace to be finished with the entire Bible in 22 years.
Wow.
How exciting is that?
We're very behind.
But we have not yet been left behind because we have not reached Revelation. My name is Jason Kirk. Emily Kirk, how are you?
I'm great, thank you.
We have reached the least popular, most disgusting, least joyful book in the entire Bible, and we're going to have some fun anyway. That's the spirit, folks. On this program, we are endeavoring our way through the entire Bible, seeking to learn things that we probably should have learned in church at kids, but people don't really teach the Bible to kids, so we're doing it ourselves, taking it upon ourselves to do it this way. We want this podcast to be welcoming to people who believe, who used to believe, who don't believe anymore, who never believed, and all things in between. We would like this to be a welcoming and affirming place for all. And the book of Leviticus. So when people say that they think the Bible is boring, they usually are referring to one of three things. One would be overly sanitized moral lessons, huge complex stories boiled down to like, don't do this or do that. They might be referring to the begats, to the idea that the Bible is nothing but long lists of genealogies, which really it's just Genesis, Chronicles, and like Matthew and Luke, and that's it. It's, come on, it's like six chapters of genealogy. Get over it, folks.
But they are boring. I'll give them that credit.
To be fair, they are boring. The third thing that people think is boring about the Bible, laws. The hundreds of commandments that mostly began to be issued by God to Moses on Mount Sinai in the form of the Ten Commandments, and just keep going through Exodus, our tabernacle episode. Keep going through Leviticus. Leviticus is like 90-something percent of it is laws. There's more laws in Numbers, Deuteronomy. These make up the reason why the five books of the Torah sometimes are called the law, the laws of Moses. The story effect is that Moses continues to download information from God as they finally begin to start making their way away from Sinai and toward Canaan. Yes, we're still at Sinai. We're episode 7 at Sinai, something like that. So, Emily, did you read Leviticus as a kid? Did you sit down and read through the whole book ever?
No. The only time Leviticus was discussed was in singing this song about the books of the Bible.
Just literally.
Saying the word Leviticus.
Saying the name of it. Okay. I mean, I definitely read it as a kid because I read through the whole thing because that was an affliction I had, is reading the entire Bible multiple times. It's kind of how you end up in this predicament many years later. So it's kind of funny because like each of our episodes to this point has been like, oh yeah, we remember this cartoon or whatever. No one has made a Leviticus cartoon. And that's for the best.
Maybe when we do our book, it'll have Leviticus stories in it.
Oh gosh. Okay. Quick content warning, heads up. Discussing Leviticus requires discussion of animal sacrifice, the homophobic verse, ancient slavery, and some general gross stuff. So, Leviticus is the heart of the law. It's a huge list of rules roughly split into half-ish about how to keep God's great meat smoker running, a quarter-ish about how to be a good person according to the priests who are running the meat smoker, and a quarter-ish about how to not act like an ancient Canaanite. So right away, we can see that only about a quarter of that sounds particularly relevant to us today in terms of daily ongoing behavior, because I am not operating a tabernacle, and we are not surrounded by Canaanites. Therefore, those parts of Leviticus, those are interesting historical artifacts, they can, form religious beliefs and so forth, but if we're talking about ethics and morals that should form the backbone of modern laws, then we should apply some scrutiny to these things. The only times that we ever went anywhere near Leviticus as kids was two verses. There is allegedly, we will discuss this, a verse about how God doesn't like gay people, and there's allegedly a verse about how you can't get a tattoo in the 1990s or 2020s or any decade therein. We would flip directly to these verses, point at the answer, and never look at the surrounding context, never learn a single thing about it, translations or interpretations. Just say, well, yeah, that's what it says. And that has impacted lots of lives. Not so much the tattoo one, the other one. Although I am going to get a tattoo of the verse in Leviticus that says you can't get a tattoo, I think. So like the verse says, don't cut yourself to honor the dead. It's like this ancient forgotten Canaanite mourning ritual. So I'm going to get a tattoo to, like, you know, R.I.P. Moses, just to really, you know, just, it's a little joke. It's just a joke between me and Moses, our guy Moses. But Leviticus has had, you know, real world lasting consequences beyond just the time it was written. Leviticus is big, heavy, deep, consequential stuff, and also super weird. And there is so much to say, so much to say about it. You know, I could do 10 episodes on Leviticus, but nobody would listen to that. You probably would stop attending somewhere with, you know, early in episode 2.
I'll just sit here next to you while you do whatever you're doing, while you ramble on some more.
But we're going to try and cram it all into one. And that's, you know, it's a challenge because this is our first time doing one book in one episode, and it's a challenge because it's Leviticus. We can do the Psalms in one episode. That's fine. They're all about either being happy or sad. Done. Ship it, right? But Leviticus, there's a lot going on. If you would like to know more, two books I like. One is Mary Douglas's Leviticus as Literature. It's an approach that sort of steps away from the rule-based way of reading text, and it just treats it as, what do these laws say about cosmology and theology? What does it say that this kind of animal is permitted to be eaten and this kind isn't? Things like that. Approaching Leviticus as a story is pretty fascinating. Also, Rob Bell's Leviticus audiobook. If you know Rob Bell, he is capable of making any part of the Bible sound like sunshine and puppy dogs, and that includes Leviticus. So we're going to go through this mostly in chapter order, where we're going to do it in chunks, or we're going to skip big swaths of stuff. You know, if you just sit down and read Leviticus, the experience is reading dozens and dozens and dozens of rules. And at first, if you just read it through once, it's going to feel kind of haphazard and random. You're going to get to parts, you know, you're talking about, like, lots of animal laws. So many animal laws. Don't work on the Sabbath. Lots of Sabbath stuff. You know, there's 5 verses on how to handle ox gorings. Different kinds of ox goring experiences.
Ever been gored by an ox?
I have not had to put any of the Leviticus ox goring verses to the test.
That's good.
There's stuff about, you know, witches. There's witch verses. You know, really weird rules where we kind of only can barely guess what they mean. Don't boil a baby animal in its mother's milk is part of the 613 laws.
Why does that have to be a law? Were people doing it?
And it's repeated multiple times in my favorite part. So all we can guess is it's a reference to some ancient Canaanite ritual, probably some sort of springtime thing. But to this day, Orthodox Jews avoid using the same utensils for meat and dairy products to, you know, let's keep the spirit of the law alive. Whatever it was that it meant at the time, you know, the important thing is honoring it in some way to this day. So Leviticus, the book of Leviticus. In the storyline, these are laws given to Moses, said to be by God, at and around Sinai, on setting up the sacrifice machine and the extended terms of service agreement. The authorship, based on what scholars know about the story, is that priests wrote this, finalized it during and after the Jewish Babylonian exile, maybe 800 years or so after when we would most likely set the story of Moses, so 500s BC. The agenda of Leviticus is priests telling other priests how to be priest. It's a priest training manual, and they're writing it 800 years after the point in the story when they would have needed it. It's retroactively pointing back to say, wait, why are we in exile in Babylon? What went wrong? God's all powerful. Is God not on our side? What did we do wrong? Well, Leviticus lays out exactly what we did wrong. Themes of Leviticus, once you look at what the rules seem to be saying, are things like holiness, contamination, separation, quarantine.
We know all about that.
Yeah, we know a little bit about that. The tabernacle is divided into sections, some of which are too holy to be broached by normal people. Priests are set apart from Israel. The way they cleanse the community is often by setting apart diseased people. Israel is set apart from Canaanites. Different food, different clothes, different rules on tattoos and beards. In every way, over and over, acting different and distinct. And in some ways, this is good. In some ways, this is bad. Women are constantly set apart from men, treated as things to be placed outside the community once a month. When the life-giving blood of creation appears, women are treated as dirty and sent into the wilderness to go hang out and be women.
Maybe we should still do that.
You think so?
Just go hang. I mean, not to be sent away, but just to be like, nope, sorry.
Just to escape men.
Yeah.
Seems pretty nice.
Sounds fine.
So parts of Leviticus feel like they're written by middle school boys who are just scared of girls. Like, ew, you know?
Well, they might have been.
I mean, they very well might have been. They're priests, total dorks. But, like, if you sort of read Leviticus in the mind of, like, it's written by, like, people who believe in cooties, it makes a lot more sense. oh, the name Leviticus, named after the Levites, the priests, who we've learned about in the golden calf story and other episodes, as they're the guys who kind of took over under Moses' leadership, and now they are the ruling warrior, priestly, doctor, lawyer class. People had a lot of jobs back then. I think it's also important in terms of distinction to say there is not necessarily a perfect correlation between morality and Leviticus holiness. Leviticus does not necessarily tell us what is right and wrong according to God forever. Leviticus tells us how to follow the rules of a specific group of priests who live in the 500 BC and like to write fanfic about Moses. Like, for example, there is a verse in Leviticus 18 about how two sisters shouldn't be in competition to bear children for the same, and that's like all of Genesis. The entire story of Genesis violates Leviticus 18. Things change, ideas change, and our ideas have changed since Leviticus, but there will always be things we can learn from it.
It is interesting, this is just a little side note, how as the Bible goes on, you see this evolution of character throughout the same people and even through God, but yet we're supposed to think that since the Bible was written, none of that has changed.
Yes. I think that has been, and people have mentioned this to us, this is like the single thing that feels like most obvious jumping out when you read the Bible in order is like, yeah, God changes. God changes God's mind. God comes up with different ideas. God thinks old things that God liked are bad now. Like, and this is like denigrated as this is called process theology. And people get very offended if you say you believe in it. But I mean, it's there. I don't know what to tell you.
You could pick out like four verses that go together and say, nope. But if you're actually looking at the Bible as a whole and you believe in the Bible as a whole, then you have to believe that things change.
I think it is easier to look at the Bible and say God changes from book to book in some way. At very least, our perception of God, our ability to understand God changes so radically that it is as if God changes. I think it's easier to say that than to say the God of Genesis 1 and the God of Genesis 2 and Genesis 3 and Genesis 5 and Exodus and Leviticus are all exactly the same in character, right?
Right.
Leviticus, obviously, like all of these other books, has lots and lots of influences. It's, you know, the first portion is about the tabernacle, Egyptian influences, the religious sacrifices, tons of Canaanite influences. We'll probably never even know the extent of them. The laws themselves, so many of them, a lot of them are more or less copies of ancient Babylonian law codes. I think most people know the Code of Hammurabi, the legendary Code of Hammurabi, this 3,800-year-old law code that, you know, very important legal history, blah, 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 and some stuff older than Hammurabi, the Code of Lippitt-Ishtar has contributed to the Bible. And, you know, it's okay to say that older things influenced the Bible. That would have been, you know, deeply radical to 14-year-old me, but listen, kid, just face facts.
Well, ideas have to start somewhere.
Sure. And I think when we look at these, the similarities are important. It's important to say that, like, the Bible was influenced by other cultures. It just was. It's also important to point out the differences. Like, you know, we talked in the creation story and the flood story about the differences between a Babylonian god who slaughters a goddess and creates people as slaves versus a Bible goddess who transforms this chaos with peaceful words and creates people as friends, right? So like the Bible was taking these super, super, super ancient ideas and I think pushing them a little bit forward towards something a little more welcoming. And there's still a lot of rough edges because, again, we're in Leviticus, but there is a progression here. One other thing about Leviticus is we kind of don't really know how strictly any of these rules are actually followed. Theologians Suzanne Schultz and Alan Cooper wrote, "We are not certain that Leviticus reflects actual or practiced law. Perhaps it represented only priestly wishful thinking. In fact, it's probable that women in ancient Israel had more rights and access to power than we assume." I mean, one book after Moses dies, a lady is in charge.
Which that kind of would make sense because we see already throughout the Bible how women are silenced. Even though many women had a large role, you don't hear so much about what those roles were. So that would back up that claim of it's priestly wishful thinking.
Yeah, yeah. Like this is a bunch of dudes saying like, wouldn't it be awesome if ladies just stopped talking and went very far away so we didn't have to look at them? Like
she's getting on my nerves.
Your mom. Yeah, this is just Levites tattling to God about their sisters are annoying them. But like, so let's get to the story. story, such as this. Exodus ends with God's pillar of fire and smoke leading the Israelites onward, then resting at the tent of meeting. Leviticus begins with God summoning Moses to the tent and explaining exactly how he wants his different sacrifices for different purposes. Here we go. There's details on entrails and kidney removal and what blood goes where and fat dripping and bulls and goats and sheep and doves and pigeons and all does different stuff. And you can break it up like it really matters what you sacrifice when for what reason, but it's like 8 chapters of just gore on and on and on. It's like tabernacle construction, but the gore version.
It's like reading through all of that, you almost start to get that metallic taste in your mouth just reading it. It's really gross.
It is indeed incredibly metal in every way. So who is in charge of all these sacrificial processes and who gets to eat a little bit of thigh meat? That's right, the priests. Who wrote these rules? That's right, the priests. It's interesting to note that there is a little bit of like a sliding tax bracket thing here. So for a priest to purify themselves enough to do priest stuff, they have to sacrifice a bull, a huge and expensive possession. A regular person can purify themselves by sacrificing a goat, but if they can't afford a goat, they could bring a sheep, they could bring 2 pigeons, they could bring some flour. It's only sort of about bringing the best. Sometimes it's about bringing your best. And when we say sacrifice, like kind of, we assume that we know what we mean when the Bible says sacrifice. We assume it means atonement and other Christian ideas. But not always. Abraham and God had sacrifices just to seal covenants. Sometimes the sacrifice is literally, hey, we're going to burn this stuff. Sometimes the sacrifice, we're going to party. Sometimes the sacrifice is to call down favor. But here, the atonement idea is most frequently what seems to be referred to in Leviticus. It's about cleansing and holiness and making yourself approachable, making it so that you no longer have to quarantine yourself away from the community and from the as close as you can get to the holy place. So the tabernacle, what it calls to mind for me is like a nuclear power plant. It's super powerful. It's great to have it. It's incredible. We can't believe it. How do we figure this out? This is amazing. It cools our houses and powers medical equipment and preserves food. It's super essential and it keeps us alive. And it can also kill us in an instant. Leviticus, the first 8 chapters are a manual on how to operate a nuclear power plant. And then chapter 10 is Chernobyl.
It's like we started all over at Genesis again. It's like you make a small mistake and poof, you're gone.
So Aaron's sons are put in charge. And it's important to note.
They were just ordained.
Aaron's sons are not like 17. These are not children. These are men. They have been among the elders since Sinai. They were on Sinai as high up as anyone but Moses could go. Like these are grown men. They've been put in charge of firing up the tabernacle for the first time. It's kind of interesting that God didn't let Aaron do it.
Sometimes it just feels like God is waiting for somebody to mess up. Just to be like, I told you.
So, yeah, they fire it up and they get fired up. These guys explode. Aaron's sons are burned and exploded.
Because they brought the wrong fire.
Yeah. So no one exactly knows what it is that they did wrong. One of the most common scholarly ideas is that they took fire out of an oven, just a regular oven. It wasn't like consecrated special fire. They just put regular fire in the tabernacle and kaboom. There's an idea from Jacob Milgram that this is all a reference to some Assyrian sacrifice method that we're supposed to think is very bad, but like the Aaron family messed things up again. Aaron got stuff blowed up. And then this is like the best dark comedy in the whole Bible. Like this happens and Aaron is standing there and the show has to go on. Moses is like, we do not have time to mourn. We've spent all this time setting this thing up. Keep it moving. And Aaron's just standing there. He's not allowed to do any mourning stuff. He's got to keep the show going. They're literally dragging bodies out, and Aaron's got to do priestly stuff. And eventually, you know, Aaron's like offering this panicked response to Moses, and Moses finally gets it, and he kind of backs off a little bit.
Well, it's like, you know, with the Cain and Abel thing kind of all over again, where it's praised for the right kind of sacrifice and admonished for the wrong.
Yeah.
This time it got him killed.
Yeah, in Cain and Abel, it's like, the lesson of Cain and Abel is like, hey man, sometimes church is just church. If you're not good at it, that's fine. Just be a good person. Like, that's ultimately the lesson.
And do better next
time. Yeah, try again next time. It's just church. The lesson of Leviticus is that sometimes church is not just church. When church involves setting up things that explode, then you have to follow the directions.
Right. There were no directions for Cain and Abel, but now Aaron's sons had directions, apparently. Yes. Even though they were brand new.
Yeah, well, used the wrong fire, so... I think one of the most obvious lessons from this is, like, you want to be a priest, huh? You sure you want to be a priest? You want to be a big guy with the big beard with the jewels on your breastplate, and, like, you get the cool oils and all that, and you smell very nice, and you get to do the cool stuff, and you get to set the thing on fire and all. You sure you want that standard? You sure you want that bar to clear? And I love how this story is going on, and, like, you know, Aaron is freaking out and trying to do his stuff, and Moses is being, like, a total jerk to him, and, you know, he just lost his two sons, and people have to be freaking out. And God's reaction to this, God is like, God, it's like God just, like, walks in the room like, oh, hey guys, oh, I thought of some more rules. So here's 47 verses on the kinds of animals we can't eat. All right, you're not going to eat camels, seagulls, bats, weasels, geckos. And, like, God is just going and going and going about animals they can't eat. And meanwhile, everyone is just freaking out. And it's like God is this, like, aloof professor walking in the door, not at all noticing the total chaos going on. He's just got a list of animals that shouldn't be eaten.
Yeah, can you imagine being there?
So the and this is actually the first, probably the first part of Leviticus that directly relates to today, is this list of animals that God just sort of wanders in and starts blurting. Of course, this ends up constituting the kosher section of your grocery store 3,000 years later. There are no camels or seagulls or bats there.
Or anywhere else in the store, probably.
Hopefully there's no seagull meat in your grocery store. I mean, I shouldn't judge. I don't know. It might be. No, I've never had it. I don't know. It's probably very salty. So one effect that I like if you want to find something positive here, here's this. God wandering back in and just saying, like, okay, Aaron, take down some more rules, blah, 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 is like, Aaron is wailing and miserable about messing everything up again. Aaron is this catastrophic failure. Oh, woe is me. I hate myself. I'm the peacemaker, and everything keeps literally exploding in front of me. The golden calf, and now this. And what does God say? What are you talking about? You're still in charge of all my weird rules. And like, I just picture Aaron looking up like, what? Me? Still? You still believe in me? Even though we keep ruining everything?
I mean, he didn't ruin it. Technically, his sons did.
His idiot sons did. This is also where we remember that Aaron, priest, Levite. Who wrote this story? Levites. Aaron was their guy. So, yeah. This is a second straight story where Aaron is kind of very close to the blame, but kind of gets to blame it on somebody else. And, yeah, Aaron's kind of...
He's golden.
Aaron's... Well, yeah. He did some golden stuff. But, like, Aaron's family wrote this story. So, after this, of course... The natural come down from this tragedy, the proper response is to have four chapters about how to deal with genital discharge and leprous discharge and household mildew, things of that nature. Just, you know, that's what people want to
hear about.
Normal
stuff.
And yeah, there's four chapters about that. Finally, Leviticus 16, after God talks about discharges for a while, God explains to Moses how to tell Aaron how to make right for that whole botching the ceremony thing.
I like how they're still punishing him at this point. Your son's exploded, but hey.
I think it's a restorative thing. Aaron, we're going to make everything cool again. Cool and good. Until the next time you do something. So this ceremony that God describes becomes Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the holiest Jewish day. Leviticus 16:8, Aaron should take two goats for a sin offering. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo. One of those goats is God's, and the other belongs to Azazel. Azazel goat goes free into the wilderness, bearing away the sin and bad vibes, and all is made new. Who is Azazel? So, this is fun. Azazel might be some word that just means, like, I don't know, the wilderness, which a lot of rabbis have thought. It might be some ancient god, some ancient wilderness demonic goat-like god. And there's some other references in Leviticus to, like, wilderness demon goats and whatever. And, like, a lot of big-time rabbis, Nachmanides and others, have argued this as well. And I think that's way more awesome if there's just, like, yeah, there's some scary goat demon
I'm
out there
called
Azazel.
I'm pretty sure there's,
Azazel.
Like, a movie or something where Azazel's the bad guy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Azazel is in Diablo. Yeah, yeah. So, like, that's the thing. Is, like, apocryphal books, if you have something in the Bible that's like, Azazel is out there, somebody's going to write an entire apocryphal book about it. There's going to be a movie. You know, I'm certain there's like nine metal bands named Azazel. The apocryphal story about Azazel is that this was some angel who led a mutiny before the flood. Great. So this goat thing, this goat idea, builds and builds and builds and becomes the ultimate inspiration for goat horns and goat fingers and goat skulls being satanic imagery to this day. When the goat is a good guy here. The goat is bearing away the sin. If you want a Christ figure in the book of Leviticus, it is the scapegoat. The scapegoat that is bearing away the sins of the community and taking them out in the wilderness. And it's not like, so this is kind of a separate thing, but like a lot of ancients concluded that the goat was then like shoved off a cliff or whatever, but it doesn't say that. It just says the goat leaves. The goat's free to be a goat. Like, sin doesn't matter to a goat. You put the sin on the goat and the goat just leaves and the goat's happy about it. Also, this is literally where the term scapegoat comes from, because I think it was the King James Version who they decided to call the Azazel goat the escape goat. So then we just started calling it the scapegoat. That's what scapegoat means, is the goat who escapes with our sins.
You know, this is fitting for a goat to be this character because goats like to eat all the trash and stuff anyway. So just devours it all.
Yeah, goats love weeds, trash, sin.
They'll take anything.
So that's the first half of Leviticus, all about how to be a priest. Great. We're halfway done. Halfway done with Leviticus. The second half is usually called the holiness code. It's about how to live within the specific, distinct, unique religious group overseen by these priests. Again, the main idea of Leviticus is being different, distinct, separate, not like the people around the Israelites, not like Canaanites, not like Babylonians. And sometimes, yeah, it's not good to be, you know, like ancient Egyptians. They had some bad ideas. Leviticus 17, do all your animal slaughtering by the tabernacle. Make sure God gets a cut, which means the priests get a cut. If you're slaughtering animals out there at camp or the wilderness, you're sinning. And this is several things. One, this is priests telling you to bring them some meat. Two, this is making sure your meat gets cooked properly. We have a community meat cooking facility. Three, this is making sure you're not hogging God's meat for yourself. Four, this is avoiding the unnecessary slaughter of animals. Kill only what you're going to eat and or sacrifice.
I wish people did this more today.
There is no trophy hunting in Leviticus.
Right.
You do not stand by a tiger you have downed in Leviticus. You better bring that tiger in. There's a lot of laws about being kind to animals. Don't let your neighbor's donkey struggle under a heavy load. Don't hurt baby birds. Remember, God said to take care of our planet. We will come back to this. Leviticus 18, personal rules begin. God's telling the Israelites how to not behave like the people in the land they're moving toward. Almost this entire chapter is about avoiding incest, implying that's how the priests viewed the Canaanites as behaving. And it lists just about any family member you could think of as being a bad person for a male to engage with. Don't have sex with your dad's sister. She's your aunt. Not your mom's sister. She's your aunt. Not your aunt, even if your uncle knows about it. And it's and there's a lot of ant stuff in Leviticus 18, and it almost reads like Moses is like, just don't do incest. And there's one guy who's there who's like, so what if my aunt is, and
what
Moses,
about her aunt?
Yeah, okay.
What about my wife's aunt?
Moses, what about your aunt? And it reads just like Moses is like, will someone please tell this pervert? So there's an ant guy that they just can't need to dump cool water on him or something. Leviticus 19:21, don't sacrifice children to Molech. I think that's a really good law.
I won't do it.
It's a reference to one of like some Mediterranean war god. And Genesis, Exodus, and Leviticus now all have stories and or laws about how it is bad to sacrifice children, bad to consume blood. And we look back at this 2,500 years later and we say, oh, well, duh. But like, yeah, at the time, this was progressive and important and good to say that is bad to do. So hooray, Leviticus 19:21. So at this point, very little of what we have read so far is directly relevant to our day-to-day lives in the 2020s as far as how we treat people, daily ethical decisions, things like that. They can be part of religious beliefs, but as far as how should we carry ourselves, how should we act on a daily day-to-day basis, you're probably not going to draw a whole ton of that from the bull being the thing that is sacrificed, kidneys first and entrails and so forth. Literally most of the total 613 commandments don't even apply right now. There are no sacrifices because there is no longer a tabernacle or a temple. There's no longer a Molech, although I'm sure there's a QAnon theory about him. No one has seen Azazel in a long time, except at a black metal show. And, you know, yeah, incest is bad, but we're not exactly in danger of assimilating with a 3,000-year-old Canaanite culture based on it. What I'm saying here is to this point in Leviticus, we're reading fascinating historical stuff that can also form part of religion,
But it's also, you got to view it through this historical context. Arguably, the first thing God says in all of Leviticus that directly applies to the 2020s is Leviticus 19:9. When you reap the harvest of your land or your vineyard, don't reap it all. Leave some for poor people and immigrants. In Leviticus, the book of God's law, the first law that super directly applies to today is about rich people foregoing profit in order to take care of poor people. Leviticus 19:13, don't rob your workers, don't do wage theft, pay people fairly. 19:14, don't take advantage of disabled people. 19:32, respect and take care of old people. 19:34, immigrants are citizens just like you. 19:35, don't cheat people just to make a few bucks. All of these things require zero Iron Age Middle Eastern context. Like, this is the super, super timeless universal stuff, regardless of your religion. Like the other stuff is religion stuff, and I don't want to insult anyone who holds dear to specific religious things, but like, to me, this is the stuff for everybody. And in parts of the law, God even goes overboard with this stuff, like says, like, don't do loans, do gifts. If someone owes you money and can't pay it back, oh well, so what? And like, Israel later realizes, like, you can't really have a society like this. So like, they come up with workarounds to where they can like do loans. And also, meanwhile, because Leviticus is Leviticus, mixed in with this like wholesome advice is, of course, weird and ancient contextual laws about witchcraft and necromancy and the tattoo thing and more Molech and don't trim your beard the wrong way. And the point is, some of this stuff is super clear, immediately applicable, no matter who you are. And then some of the stuff is either part of your religion and or stuff that you gotta really think about and ponder how relevant it is to the 2020s. And that is basically how Leviticus is set up. There's a chapter toward the end that we'll come back to, but there's some stuff about like setting up holidays and rituals and calendars and stuff. And then that's the majority of the law. Numbers has some laws mixed in about offerings and holidays and how to live as a Nazarite, different from a Nazarene.
Mm-hmm.
A Nazarite, of course, it's sort of an ascetic. Someone has taken a vow of extra religious piety. Then Deuteronomy it adds a lot of like clauses and details and stuff, and a lot of like Numbers in Deuteronomy add some more laws. There's some laws in Exodus, and there's actually some laws in Genesis, and these form the 613. The very basic gist of the law is, first, love God. Second, love each other. Some of it is about treating people fairly and loving your neighbor. That stuff is easy to understand. Some of it is about stuff that has not mattered for 2,000 years. That stuff is fascinating history. So, as always with the Bible, there are exceptions. I think the simplest way to read it is to say, what is the baseline, consistent, overall ethic of the whole thing? And I think, you know, take care of people is the most immediately applicable thing that jumps out. That and this idea of holiness and cleanliness that is sort of alien to how we approach religion these days, I think. Like, maybe in some good ways, maybe in some bad ways, but it's a big, big different idea.
I think that's part of like wearing your Sunday best, where all that came from. And a lot of people have even strayed from that more these days. Like, nobody does that except for like Easter.
I've never done that. I don't,
really? That surprised me. Wearing your Sunday best?
I mean, I was like made to when I was like 8.
Yeah. Yeah, but I feel like that's where like the cleanliness aspect comes from. Like, you're going to present your cleanest self.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't think any people who worry about Sunday best read a lot of Leviticus. It's probably more like...
No, it's just tradition at that point.
Yeah. So yeah, the bad stuff in Leviticus. Let's drill down a little bit on some of these. Yeah, there are multiple visions of acceptable slavery in the law, and there's a lot of reasons for that. One reason for there being multiple visions is multiple people wrote it at multiple times. In Exodus, slavery is viewed as a 6-year worker's contract meant to pay off a debt. In Leviticus, enslaving anyone but an Israelite for life is okay. These are
weird,
quite different and bad. And the Bible has bad ideas, and you can make endless arguments about how, you know, slavery at the time wasn't as bad as America's generational chattel slavery. You could argue that if you really want. It's still bad. It was bad. Like, I don't think it's fair to say like, oh, the standards of the times. No, it was bad. It was wrong. Slavery was wrong.
I don't see slavery as a good thing under any form or any.
Yeah, like the idea in Leviticus of like, you can take a prisoner of war and make him your slave. Like, any God who said that is wrong, and that's okay to say.
Yeah.
One thing to remember is that many rabbis conclude God only dictated the first two commandments. The rest of this is Moses telling us what God said. So what happens if a later verse by Moses delivered in the middle of Leviticus contradicts a verse Moses delivered while standing right in front of Sinai? What happens if Moses delivers a verse that says slavery is okay in certain circumstances, and we say, wait a second, I thought you said thou shalt not steal, because slavery is stealing someone's life.
liberty, agency, etc., etc. So to me, you know, looking at this verse and saying, does this fit within thou shalt not steal? No. So I think it's fair to say that this verse does not stand up to the law's own standards. So can you use the Bible to justify basically anything? Yeah, you can, if you really want to. Does that make it okay? Of course not. No. And there's like, you know, endless things you could say about this subject. And I don't want to just breeze past like it's light, like this has had massive consequences for literally millions and millions and millions of people. And the failure of the Bible's authors to be as progressive with this as they were on some other things, that is a heavy cost. And that is a thing for the Bible to reckon with. Next thing on this list, the idea of eye for an eye, which might be the most famous quote from Leviticus, you know, the idea of like retribution and justice. And if someone hurts you, you should hurt them in exactly the same way. This is like hugely misunderstood. This is one of the laws that's almost a direct quote from Hammurabi's laws, which means this is like 4,000 years old. We take it to mean meet violence with violence, hurt the people who hurt you, rah, rah, blood and vengeance and suffering and hoorah. I've even referenced it just as a saying in a previous episode without even thinking about it. Like everybody does it, right?
Right.
So let's say you do take eye for an eye literally. Okay. Even then, it is a reform of some older law codes in older nations. It's easy to look at an eye gouging law and say, oh gosh, how barbaric. But 3,000 years ago, this would have been an upgrade over what some other surrounding nations were doing. Eye for an eye taken literally is about commensurate equal fair loss. It's not a life for an eye. It's not two eyes for an eye. It's focused on just the perpetrator. It's not the eyes of the guy who made the knife and the guy who sold the stabber the donkey and the donkey, just the guy who did the stabbing. But it's not literally about eyeballs. Do we think eye gougings were one of the 613 most common crimes? It's a metaphor. Like a lot of these laws are like, it's not just about specifically ox gorings. It's not just about if a donkey falls down a well. It's about take this metaphor scenario and apply it to other relevant situations. Many Jewish commentators, going back to Josephus and the Talmud thousands of years ago, have argued the Israelites would have understood eye for an eye as an ancient way of referring to monetary compensation for victims of violence. As in, you lose an eye, you receive the value of an eye from the person who took your eye, not you get to cut their eyeball out. It's not necessarily about extracting the perpetrator's literal eyeball. Like, what good does that do you? What good is that fun? Is that a lot? I mean, it might be kind of fun, ooh, but I mean, if you're really mad at them because they took your eye.
Yeah, but that sounds horrible.
It sure it does. So like, the law isn't necessarily about like revenge and vengeance and all that stuff. It's about making the victim as whole as we can. One rabbi in the Talmud asked a few questions about like the, you know, the idea of taking eye for an eye literally. How would you enforce a literal eye for an eye law if the person who took the eye didn't have any eyes to begin with? Are they just, it's a loophole, they just get away with it? Like if say there's this guy going around called the eye stabber and he stabs someone in the eye and the punishment for that is they take one of the eye stabber's eyes. Well, then he does it again and they take his other eye. Well, now what? Now he can just do it all he wants without any punishment? No, that's not how it worked. The first person whose eye he took, he had to pay that person for the eye. If he couldn't afford it, then there is a 6-year worker's term where he worked off the debt and so forth. And then he was free to stab another eye. But yeah, eye for an eye, it's not literal. It's about monetary compensation, the value of an eye. Here's a quick one, abortion, which is like, I think people think it's in Leviticus. I was probably taught it's like, around there somewhere, but like, I mean, it's not. There's a law in Exodus 21, a verse about if you knock over a pregnant woman, and the specific metaphor is like, if two idiot boys are fighting and they knock over a woman and she miscarries, you have to pay a fine. But if you hurt her, that is a much bigger deal. And there are billions of interpretations on all sides. Some people saying this shows that a miscarriage is an injury to a second person. I think the more immediate implication is that the woman's life is of much more value than the fetus's life. But like the fact that you can have so many people arguing back and forth about whether this means we should have stricter abortion laws 3,000 years later, and it's like we're kind of not even agreeing what the verse literally says. Like, I don't know how useful this verse is.
We just don't knock down pregnant people.
Yeah, I mean, that's one. It's probably the simplest takeaway. Mm-hmm. Fellas,
I'll try to avoid it.
Let's try not to knock over pregnant ladies. The other verse in the Torah that I mean, sort of, kind of, ish relates to abortion. There's a passage in Numbers 5 that Well, it's about how a priest can induce a miscarriage if a pregnancy is outside marriage.
Huh.
Pretty interesting. I did not learn that one as a conservative Southern Baptist youth.
A priest, you say?
A priest can induce a miscarriage. But it's also, it's like this weird, like, it's kind of like Testa Lady witchcraft kind of thing. It probably should not be the basis of 21st century laws, but it's pretty interesting that it's in there. It is pretty interesting that it is in there. Okay, so mentioned that there were basically two verses that we ever heard about as kids. One about, you know, don't get tattoos. So I'm going to run through a list of, I think, things people think the Bible says, and then we'll talk about what's actually in there. I think a thing people think the Bible says is that gay marriage is forbidden. Well, there are no Torah laws explicitly about marriage at all. Just a few about divorce. Remember, the laws were written down by Moses. He just got divorced, chapter 4, Sinai. Of course, Moses has a lot of feelings about divorce to relay through the laws. There is no verse in the Bible that says a man shall not marry a man, a woman shall not marry a woman. I think people think
a family is only between a man and a woman.
Yeah, it does not say God made Adam and Eve or whatever. Like, it's just not in there. Wait, I got that back. Yeah.
It doesn't say it's Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve.
Right. I think people would say, well, okay. The Bible forbids being gay, right? Well, first, there is not a single syllable in the Hebrew Bible against two women being in any kind of relationship, and nowhere does it regulate how much two men can love each other. I think someone might hear that and say, and I feel like I'm having an argument with, like, I don't know, maybe like my 11-year-old self or something like that. And that kid might say, like, yeah, well, the Bible forbids like doing gay stuff, right? And I think to that child, I would say, but so you mean like, you know, hugging and kissing and sleeping together for warmth, and King David literally having a male soulmate, and they tell each other they love each other more than they love women, because, like, that's okay in the Bible? And so then, let's see, I think the retort would be like, yeah, well, the Bible forbids, you know, gay sex, like Sodom and Gomorrah and the other references. And of course, we have discussed how Sodom and Gomorrah is not about that.
There wasn't anything really about that. There was more about the way that they were looking at the women.
Yeah. Sodom and Gomorrah is an extreme story about how vital hospitality was to trade routes in the Middle East. It is not about any particular kind of romance. It's just not. Some people point to a kind of similar story in Judges 19 as if it says gay sex is bad. It's like this, Judges 19 is messed up. It's like this horror movie just dropped in the middle. And like God is like not really involved at all. Nothing in it is presented as good. It's just like people are slaughtered and dismembered and like,
oh, can't wait for that one.
Like nothing about it makes you think like, ah, this is the way people should act. This is good. This is how, like, Judges 19 is a mess. There are no morals to draw from it.
That's the kind of book where you wonder when people are like, you know, in the Facebook comments, they're always like, well, I don't live my life worldly. I follow the Bible. And it's like, which parts of the Bible do you follow? Because have you read it?
Oh, man. Leviticus, like, so as a kid, you do the thing where it was like, you open the book to a random page and point at a verse, and that's what the Lord wants to say to you today. If you do that and you get Leviticus and it's like, the Lord has a lot of thoughts about goats today, okay?
I feel like it's usually, though, like, but lean toward the back in the New Testament.
I think what they count on is Psalms is really big. Psalms, yeah, is hard to miss, and it's in the middle. So, like, they're not counting on you hitting Leviticus, but it's like, listen, I don't know what the Lord is saying to me about mildew, but that's what was on the Lord's heart today. There's a lot in Leviticus about mildew. And yeah, so let's see. The New Testament has 5 homophobic references. And all 5 can be attributed to Paul, a self-admitted super fundy who became a guy with a lot of opinions about a man he'd never met except in a vision. So Paul having a lot of opinions has been very consequential, but Paul's not Jesus. And there are numerous theories that Paul might have been doing a little bit of projecting and self-loathing with some of his homophobic verses.
It seems to be a common thing. It's still happening today.
Which would not be a surprise. For more on the 6 verses in the entire Bible, there are 31,000 verses in the Bible. People use 6 of them to say it's wrong to be gay. For more takedowns of those verses, see the book by Colby Martin called Unclobber. These verses are called the Clobber verses because gay people get clobbered with them. Okay, we are now to the one of them that is in Leviticus. And I think the thing that 11-year-old me might say about it is, okay, the Bible forbids one specific kind of gay sex. Okay. Leviticus 18:22 says, per a general consensus of translations, something like, don't lie with a man as you would with a woman. If this is definitely sex and it's to be taken literally, it would have to refer to a specific act, since nothing else would really be specific to just a woman. So two fellas, you could do all sorts of things and not break the specific rule. Also, it says lay, so you can stand. That's fine.
But there's also theories that this is mistranslated to start with.
Yeah, I mean, so like there's a ton. There's like the idea that, hey, this is amongst all the like incest verses and stuff. So like, what if it is literally more about a very young man treating a young man as you would a grown woman? What if that's what it's about? Like a lot of people, the author K. Renato Lings argues it's more about incest and not about two grown men in a committed relationship or any kind of relationship. Also, I saw one interpretation that you can take this translation far enough to say it's about two dudes sleeping in a bed that belongs to a woman. Like, which, I mean, you know, if you walk in your house and there's two dudes in your bed, you know, sure, you would think there should be a law against this. This is my bed, not theirs. Which you would say like, oh, that's ridiculous. Why would that be a law in the Bible? Why are you're trying too hard to say it's not about what it's clearly about? Why would there be a rule against two dudes sleeping in a bed? And it's like, do you know how many ridiculous laws there are in Leviticus? This would not be the weirdest law if there's a law against two dudes sleeping in the bed.
It's true.
Like, there's literally laws about boiling cows in milk, and there can't be a law about two dudes sleeping in the wrong bed. So I think someone might point out that whatever these two fellas are doing is described as an abomination. Okay, boy, that's a heavy word, isn't it? Abomination can be translated as taboo, as described by the person writing down the law, a straight man named Moses and or a bunch of straight guys who are like Moses. And like the taboo, it could just mean like you can't be part of our animal sacrifice cult anymore. So you got to live on the other side of the hill with the Canaanites. And like that might be more fun. And we have this idea that when we see abomination, that means like people are just getting stoned and left and right. Okay, find the verse where that happens. Find the verse where someone is murdered and God says it's awesome strictly because that person is gay. Find that verse. Good luck.
Right.
Remember eye for an eye? How we can't take every single thing literally? And finally, I think, you know, even acknowledging that, like, okay, this verse, this clobber verse, is a lot more complicated than we were led to believe in middle school youth group. I think someone would still counter, okay, but like I'm just generally convinced that those things are wrong, right? And to that, I think we should keep in mind that all the laws are what someone writing in the voice of Moses told us about what the character Moses understood God to be saying 3,000 years ago. It's a message to a people who in real life were surrounded by enemy nations that practice incest, so it's simple to read these laws as referring to that. It's quite possibly a forceful argument in favor of procreation, and that is not one of our problems here in the 21st century. Either way, it's an argument delivered by a heterosexual father who had been raised in the Egyptian patriarchy. And even if Moses meant homophobia with all his heart, well, Moses is recorded making a mistake every few chapters in Moses' own story. Moses isn't perfect. So if Moses meant this with all his heart, okay, Moses was wrong. So why are we going through all this trouble with this verse to contextualize, to counter, to try and retranslate? Why go through all this fuss? The answer's pretty simple. This verse is still actively weaponized against people to this day. So there are lots of ways to approach that fact. I think one of them is to fight fundamentalism with fundamentalism and to say, you really want to take the Bible literally? You want to take it all literally? Okay, we can play that game too. And, you know, just sort of drown them in red tape until they get
until
bored.
Until they run away.
Until they get bored and forget whatever it was they're mad about, right? That's
but then hopefully they won't use that argument again.
Yeah, because they'll be too exhausted. And that's the thing. Don't let it be easy. Like, that is how I would most love to approach that situation is if someone, you know, if I were to encounter someone using this verse against someone, a young person, whoever, I would love to just launch in and say like, hey, let me talk for 59 minutes and 43 seconds so far on this Zoom recording. And it's until you are so bored that you just give up on it, right? Like, I'm here to filibuster you.
He will too. He will win.
I'm just going to ramble and ramble and ramble until you leave that kid alone, right? Because this verse in Leviticus and other verses in Leviticus have been weaponized against people, but we must keep in mind what the prophet Isaiah said, which is that no weapon formed against you shall prosper, and that includes Leviticus itself. We shall refute every voice that rises against you in judgment. If a bigoted person wants to use verses in Leviticus to argue for bigotry in the 2020s, there are a few things that bigot will have to agree to do. They're going to have to avoid certain kinds of haircuts, avoid all multi-fabric clothing. They're going to have to eat only kosher food. They have to take care at all times to avoid 100 different animal faux pas.
Which actually I doubt that they do, especially the ones in regards to hunting.
Yeah, man. Yeah, man. You got deer antlers on your wall.
In the wild, and man, it wasn't sacrificed in the right way.
Yeah, man. Woo. Talk about abomination, bro. That's you. You know what else you're going to have to do? You know what else you're going to have to do? If you think you like Leviticus, Leviticus 25, you're going to have to become a radical, anti-capitalist, environmentalist, commune dweller. Because Leviticus 25, in every seventh year, you got to stop exploiting the land. You got to give Mother Nature a break. Stop making money. Stop chasing profits. Spend a year resting. Not just the bosses, but women and workers and livestock and even wild animals. I don't even know how to give a wild animal a break for a year, but just attempting that sounds like the most peaceful thing I've ever heard. I will stop troubling the butterflies and so forth because I'm following the Sabbath year. So, like, you think you want to look like a Levitical law code back on us? Well, okay, that's the world now. As every 7 years, you got to just shut off the economy. And what does that mean? Do you get to just shut it off and go out into the wilderness? No. The rest of it still applies. You still got to take care of people. We have to trust each other to get through that seventh year together.
It's amazing to me that we have held on to this belief of, from that one verse, of being gay being bad, but yet global warming isn't real. I don't get it. Like, how do you're talking about the world that God created, this planet that you live on, this universe that you're in, and you don't have to take care of it. That's fine. We'll get rid of all the rules about taking care of your surroundings.
Genesis 1 says, take care of Earth, right? Yeah, that doesn't matter. There's a verse in Leviticus about how my neighbor is, his dance music, I don't like it, right? Like, what about Genesis 1? There is like a whole chapter about how every 7 years you have to be a socialist, okay? Also, after every seven of these seventh years, as in every 50 years, comes the mega Sabbath year. Oh my gosh, the year of Jubilee. Every debt is wiped out. Everyone who had to sell their home in order to survive gets their home back. Real estate deals are all temporary with prices that reflect this because everybody's getting their own stuff back eventually. Leviticus 25, all property is theft. God said so. You still like Leviticus, Mr. Pastor?
Can you imagine the mess that would make if everyone abided by this still?
Well, if you had to plan for it, if you had to know this would happen. Because like it has this whole system of like, Leviticus 25 has this whole system of like, if you sell it in this year, it's understood to be prorated for this number of years, and it's only going to be good for that number of years. And then like the family who live there, they will be back because they will have their dignity. They will have their place. Like with anything else in Leviticus, we kind of have no idea if this is ever actually done, if the year of Jubilee was just a really cool idea that no one could ever get everybody on board with or whatever. But like,
is it mentioned again anywhere in the Bible?
Mm-mm.
So it makes me think it didn't happen because I feel like it would have lasted more than like once.
Yeah, I mean, it feels hard to get everybody on board with, but hey, man, I thought you said you liked Leviticus laws. I thought you said we should act more like Leviticus. Okay, here comes the Green New Deal then. This is like mega Green New Deal. This is like beyond the parody of the Green New Deal. Like Karl Barth, the theologian from like 100 whatever years ago, he once said, referring to the idea that Jesus was a socialist, he was like, dude, Jesus is way more socialist than the socialists. And here in Leviticus, that's, yeah, man, yep. Like, there's one verse about tattoos. There's like a whole chapter about how nobody owns anything because it's all God's, so y'all just shut up, stop making money, and get along. And yeah, someone might say like, oh, that's impossible. Leviticus 25, the idea is impossible, it'd never work. Oh, okay, now we're picking and choosing verses to follow. Oh, okay.
It's interesting still, too, that you mentioned the tattoo thing again, because that is another one that Christians have really held on to,
kind of,
for whatever reason.
Not cool pastors.
No, not it, but you see that more now, but like when we were growing up, tattoos were a big deal.
Oh, sure.
And I mean, I feel like it was not that long ago, but it kind of was.
Yeah. It's one where I think Christians kind of just had to realize, like, how uncool do you really want to be?
Right.
Is this really the hill?
Well, my grandma, she made a comment when I got my first tattoo. She said, I just don't know what to think anymore because white trash get tattoos.
So what?
Well, but it was just kind of that moment where she was like realizing, well, I'm not white trash, but you have a tattoo. So what does my brain do with this?
Oh, okay. So it's reckoning with, that's not so bad.
Yeah, it kind of was. The tone was
the
bad.
The out loudness of the reckoning Yeah. Leviticus 26, if you don't keep these Sabbath years, if you don't give the land a break, guess what will be broken is you. You will be removed from the land, and the land will get its break for the number of years that you failed to give it its break. The land will get its reckoning. The earth will get its due with or without you. Like, Leviticus 26 is, you talk about a prophecy in the Bible. I mean, the rapture's not in the Bible. The Antichrist, he's been dead for 1900 years. Prophecies in the Bible, almost all of them, it's all about way, way, way old stuff that happened at the time. Leviticus 26, there's your prophecy in the Bible. Give the land a break or the land will break you.
This is like that Mark Wahlberg movie, The Happening.
this is when Saruman runs off all the Ent wives and the Ents come to overthrow Isengard is what's happening in Leviticus 26. So it is good to argue about these things. And like, we're kind of like, at least in churches like mine, we're kind of raised to like, no, don't argue. It says right there, thing I don't like equal bad. Don't look at the rest. And it's like, okay, all the rest is boring. I won't. But like, you're supposed to argue. And there is no law that says we should never argue about these things or expand or evolve. In Judaism, there's the idea of the oral Torah. It was this collection of rabbinical laws and wisdom, lasted for hundreds of years, largely after Ezra finished editing the Hebrew Bible. Lots of those arguments make their way into the Talmud, which is three times the size of the Hebrew Bible. So like, the DLC just kept coming. People just kept arguing about all this stuff. And like, one cool example is the first C-section happened in India about 1,000 years after Moses and like a couple hundred years after the Bible was finalized. So it's like, okay, how are you supposed to regulate that if your laws are already set in stone forever? And in the Talmud, we have rabbis talking about, okay, what are the religious implications of C-sections according to the Torah, according to our traditions, blah, blah, blah. We hope both the child and the mother can survive, which like, that was wild 2,000 years ago. It was like possible for a woman to survive a C-section. Like,
yeah, I wouldn't have wanted to get one back then.
It sounds like a bad time. But the point was, these laws have always adapted, you know, and we talked in our Ten Commandments episode about the idea of like, is it okay for a Jewish person to drive a car to a synagogue on the Sabbath? Does that count as work? A machine is working. You had to turn on the machine. There's fire. There's combustion, right? So like, these things have always been debated, and that's good. They gotta update with the times. For Christians, the law is complex because Jesus loved it, memorized it, debated it all day long, interpreted it like a rabbi would, offering some original ideas and some traditional ideas, and he ultimately came down on sort of this vibe of like, hey, the way to keep it is to exceed it, not the letter, but the spirit. The way to keep the law is to follow the law in a way where it is clear your guiding ethic is to treat people as well as you possibly can and to place the onus on yourself to take responsibility for your actions and your thoughts. Not so much to judge other people for whether they can keep the law, but to keep it yourself to the highest standard. And then Paul came along and, oh God, Paul came along and said like that, yeah, the law doesn't matter, except you got to do all the stuff and it's not you, it's Jesus in your spirit in you, and my flesh is bad and I don't like myself, and the law is bad. And like, I don't, Paul had a hard job. All right. Paul had a really hard job. He was like the first person to explain this entire idea of Christianity. And he kind of fumbled, and I really wish he had an editor, but like, Paul made things pretty.
I don't think you can get a job as his editor.
Paul made things pretty confusing. He did his best. He made things pretty confusing. But like, the law in Christianity is like, it's treated as like this totally forgotten thing that doesn't exist. Like, Leviticus is treated as like this absolute vestigial, obsolete thing we no longer need, except for when you got to pull out a verse that says it's okay to be mean to specific groups of people. Jesus interacted with the law not as a lone genius or as an eradicator, but as one rabbi in a long tradition hundreds of years before him and thousands of years after him. When he wrote, "He who is without sin cast the first stone," he was not the first rabbi to ever have a jarring opinion on a Torah law. He was not the first man in Israel brave enough to offer a dramatic contrary opinion. He was one of many intelligent rabbis who challenged each other on it all the time. There's a record of hundreds of years of arguments on the law, filled with questions, counter-questions, fanfic narratives, arguments, and open-ended resolutions. Thousands and thousands of teachers like Jesus have viewed the law as a conversation in which God was the one who spoke first. And that's Leviticus, kind of. I mean, there's so much more. Oh, God, there's so much more. But that's kind of Leviticus. See, that was fun, right?
Oh, so fun.
So fun. This has been the Vacation Bible School podcast. Next time we will have like actual stories. There's stories and numbers. There's espionage, talking animals. Oh yeah, insurrections. Yeah, we got exciting stuff coming. Thank you for enduring Leviticus. And if you have any interest in supporting this podcast, we got stuff at patreon.com/VBS podcast. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram, VBS podcast. One last thing. So the year of Jubilee concept has been used at times to justify Zionist Palestinian apartheid, the continued taking of land from Palestinians because that land belonged to Israel many centuries ago. If we try to apply it in that way now, I think you could just as easily argue this land belongs to the Canaanites who were there first, according to the book of Genesis and the book of Joshua. I think the overall argument of the year of Jubilee is that this land does not just belong to any one person, any one group of people. This land belongs to God. And the overall consistent message of the law is that regardless of who has a claim to the land, you still have to treat people who are on the land as if it is their land.